Humberto Leal is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute the Mexican citizen by injecting him with massive doses of drugs usually used to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Attorneys for Leal say the conditions of his arrest violated a treaty on consular relations and that his execution would jeopardize the rights of Americans abroad. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Kelly Epstein, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special interview guest Dennis Longmire, professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. The Execution Watch begins.
This is Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston. You can listen on the World Wide Web via kpft.org and via executionwatch.org. We are gathered in the studio tonight because Humberto Leal, a prisoner in Texas, he is from Mexico, though he's been most of his life in the United States, is scheduled for his execution. I appreciate Amy Goodman's using this story as the swan song of her show just past this break, and she talked with some of Humberto's attorneys leading up to this event. So this information is very much on the minds of the holdover listeners. And as is customary when we do these shows, by the way, my name is Ray Hill. I'm the host. We have Jim Skelton. We have that wonderful voice that began the show earlier, and we will be visiting with Kelly Epstein, who is at the Huntsville Vigil. Dave Atwood as the interview guest will be Dennis Longmire. But right now we go to Huntsville. I just lost Huntsville. Hello, are you there? Nope. Are you there? So that means that executive producer Elizabeth Stein has extra work to do, and so she will lead into it and see if she can get through. By the way, none of this would even be possible if it weren't for Elizabeth Stein. She puts all of this together and hands us a cheat sheet, and we just take it and run. Mr. Leal is a long story. We need to know what's going on in Huntsville because that tells us whether or not things are proceeding according to the ritual of execution. If you are a new listener to the show, we've been doing this for some time. You can listen to all previous shows on our website, theexecution.watch. Ms. Epstein? Kelly?
Yes.
You're on the air. What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, about 2 minutes ago, Ray, the witnesses just walked over. Now, the scene is fairly chaotic. It's not like as anything that we've really seen before. There's a couple of dozen prison employees that are standing behind the tape, a state trooper car in front of the tape, and there's about eight or nine family members here, and maybe, 16, 18 protesters and a ton of media. So there seems to be a lot going on.
So that, in other words, there's a little more security than you're accustomed to seeing.
Absolutely.
I don't ever recall a state trooper car being along the line.
No, sometimes they drive by, but he's stationed there. They also, something interesting we haven't seen is they also had a yellow tape up where the witnesses walk out of the house across the street to the prison, which they don't usually have. So they're taking, it looks to me like, very extreme precautions.
All right. But they have crossed the road.
Yes, they have.
I need to inform the listeners that the first thing that happens to give us an indication that this execution is moving forward is that the witnesses cross the road. They go from the old administration building into the walls itself, and by some circuitous route, they will wind up in the death chamber. Now, if there are any witnesses appearing for the victims, those come in a different place. So those coming in to witness this execution have been invited there by Mr. Leal, Humberto Leal, and then there's the media witnesses which go in almost simultaneously. How's the mood of the crowd?
Very quiet. The media practically outnumbers us, and they've been very, very busy scurrying around doing interviews, but it's actually very quiet. That's why we're surprised that there's such a presence of correctional officers.
Well, I suspect the correctional officers are there to protect everybody from the media, because this is certainly a national and an international story that we just got through listening to Amy Goodman, and she closed out her program with a report, and there have been program reports on MSNBC, CNN, and other stations that I have heard today. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go. If anything happens, get in touch with Elizabeth, and we'll get back to you.
All right, Ray. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kelly. So that is our report, and it's from Kelly Epstein, and she is standing by with the vigilance and the media in Huntsville to give us a report of what's going on there. Jim, let's not even get into the international stuff yet. What about this case as a case? What's different?
What I've done, if you don't mind, I'll let Susan Ashley. What I've done, if you don't mind, sure. I'll let Susan Ashley go into the facts. And after going into the facts, I'll talk a little bit about some of the legal problems.
Okay. The facts of the case are, this is a sad and horrific case, but these are the facts. There was a 16-year-old girl, Adria Saucedo, and she apparently went to a party. And this party, Humberto Leal was also at this party. At some point, Saucedo became extremely intoxicated, and she was placed in Leal's car. Humberto Leal drove off with her. About 30 minutes later, Leal's brother arrived at the party and started yelling that Leal had come home with blood on him and saying he had killed a girl. People started to look for Saucedo, and they called the police. After they called the police found her nude body on a dirt road. Saucedo's head had been bashed in, and it was bleeding. That's what the police saw when they arrived. Saucedo was lying on her back. She had a 30 to 40-pound chunk of asphalt lying partially on her arm, and there was blood underneath the rock. A smaller rock with blood on it was located near Saucedo's right thigh. Saucedo's head was spattered with blood, and there was a bloody and broken stick protruding from her vagina. Later that day, police questioned Leal. They found Saucedo's blouse. It contained blood, hair, and fibers. Police also confiscated Leal's clothing, and they found blood and bodily fluids on his clothing. Blood stains were on the passenger side of the door of his car, and police arrested Leal at his home. The medical examiner testified that Saucedo died from blows to the head, and there were also injuries that appeared to be consistent with her being strangled, manual strangulation, and she apparently had three bite marks on her body that apparently matched the dental impressions of Leal's teeth. At trial, Leal admitted taking Saucedo from the party, and what he said was he turned in the opposite direction from the way she had directed him, and then she attempted to get out of the car, and he restrained her. He said that when she got out of the car, he tried to pull her back, and that she started hitting him, pushing him and scratching him, and that he pushed her, and that she apparently fell, and he felt the back, when she was on the ground, he felt the back of her head, and it was wet, and he shook her in an attempt to wake her up, that blood started to come out of her nose, and that he fled in fear. That was basically his story at trial. And then at the punishment phase, apparently there was testimony that Leal had sexually assaulted another teenage girl and bit her on the neck, and after this assault that he repeatedly called the older girl's sister, threatening to have someone kill her if she testified against him or if she reported the crime.
Was that in the case prior to this case?
Well, that was at the punishment phase. Yeah, so the punishment phase, yeah. they would be able to bring in.
But the threats to the sister was the prior case.
Yes, that was the prior case. Okay. Oh, yeah, the prior case.
I think that other case, too, was just 2 weeks before this
murder.
It was
2 weeks.
And I also think in this case, too, you might have left out, wasn't she sexually assaulted, too?
Well, yes. She was sexually assaulted.
Meaning the young lady who died.
Yes. The young lady who died was sexually assaulted, and the other woman 2 weeks earlier, the other teenage girl, was sexually assaulted as well.
Okay. So in a two-week period of time, we have two major crimes and all
right.
of that. So that's a pretty good indication for future dangerousness as far as
the hard to argue against right. it, wouldn't you, Ray?
Well, we know what... came out in the trial and all that. Jim, what happened to the rest of the legal action?
Let me explain. To understand this case is not, you have to understand a lot of legal gobbledygook. First off, we have a thing in law that you're familiar with, the listeners may not be. Whenever the police violate the law but not warning somebody or not giving them a Miranda warning, what happens, they don't dismiss the case. All the courts do is exclude evidence that police got as a result of that, not warning someone.
Yeah, that's Miranda stuff.
It's called the Miranda stuff.
Yeah, if you divulge something and they get evidence as a result of that and you have not been Mirandized, then that is...
Excluded. Called exclusionary rule.
Right.
So in this particular case, what the big flap has been on appeal is that this man was a Mexican citizen and that... he wasn't advised of his right to see his consul. The problem is real simple in this case, is he theoretically was a citizen, but really was a resident of Texas, because he and his family had moved from Monterey to Texas when he was 2 years old. He was born and reared in San Antonio.
Okay, where the crime happened.
Where the crime occurred. And although theoretically he was a citizen, the truth of the matter, he was a resident, really, of the United States. I'm sure somebody would have asked him. He wouldn't say, I'm from Monterey. He'd say, I'm from San Antonio. And so what happened years ago, there was a treaty called the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. And what the treaty basically said, and America's a part of this treaty, is that when a foreign national is arrested in another country, he should be promptly advised of his right to see his consul.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has been the big argument, that he was not advised of his right to see his consul. There's two big problems with that. Number one, the treaty envisions instances where students are living overseas, where somebody's visiting a different country. Like, for example, this frisky frog who jumped
sure.
the bones of that gal in New York. It envisions people like that. It doesn't really envision somebody who's living permanently in a different country, just didn't bother to change their citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite sure that had he contacted the Mexican consulate, and they would have, assuming they would have advised him of that, and he would have contacted the Mexican consulate, and they would have found out that he'd been living in the U.S. since he's been two. And once they found out the facts of the case, I'm pretty sure what they would have said is follows. You can take an attempt of aerial act of intercourse, rotating piece of pastry. We're not going to help you. I don't think they would have done a thing to have helped him.
Well, and in reality, this doesn't deal with the evidence of the case. It deals with a protocol matter. And even if it happened or didn't happen, it would not have excluded any evidence
exactly.
anyway.
Because, see, the problem would have been, we don't know. We have the thing called the exclusionary rule, and no evidence was gathered as a result of...
The consul not being called.
Because, see, prior to his arrest, remember, you only get that right when you're arrested. Prior to his arrest, people saw him at a party with a girl, saw him get in the car with a drunk girl, saw him leave the party with a drunk girl. So I heard his brother come back saying that his brother had killed somebody who was covered with blood. Then they find the bloody blouse, blood in the car. All this was done before the arrest. And contacting the consulate wouldn't have been a damn bit of good, because that evidence was already there. You can't change that. The DNA evidence, if there was any, because I don't know, the opinions were not published.
There's a lot of talk about blood and body
and all
fluids.
That. Body and all fluids. That. I'm sure there was DNA evidence, and that would have not been suppressed, and there really would be no suppression issue involved. And so, number one, what happened, the big argument has simply been made, well, that will endanger other citizens in the U.S. People could take that opinion.
Let me approach that
okay.
with a little broader base.
Okay.
And I want to open this up for the whole table. we sign these conventions, which are actually treaties.
Right.
And they go through some due process to get legislated, the acceptance. All right, we're going to play by these rules. But then they don't get specific on how that is applied, you were telling me before the show.
Here's what happened. When you have a treaty passed, the problem has been there's just nothing, but Congress did nothing to implement it. Meaning implementing means simply this. They didn't pass legislation saying the police should or should not advise somebody when they're arresting with their foreign national of their right to see the consulate. Doesn't provide a remedy in case of a violation. It's much like building a car not having a motor in it. Until that's implemented, the treaty has no teeth.
Now, the hour before this show, mm-hmm. at the tail end of Amy Goodman's show, mm-hmm. one of Mr. Leal's attorneys was explaining to Amy on her show mm-hmm. that there is drafted and ready to be acted on legislation concerning the implementation of this convention. But it has not started through the process of House and Senate consideration. So it's not developed law. It is proposed law, which is doesn't carry the same weight, I presume.
One thing she left out, this is the third attempt to do that. They've done it on two different occasions, and it's fatal. It's never been passed. And this is the third attempt to get legislation through. And even if they got legislation through, the most they would ever do is grant a hearing in federal court. That's not likely to happen because the trend has been heretofore that federal courts have been not letting state people do writs in their courts, have been cutting off the writ access to federal courts. And number one, they didn't tell you that what they're trying to do is get a stay of execution waiting for Congress to act, and that could be forever. Because remember, this is the third attempt they've made to try to get the legislation.
Yeah, but you know, if you want to see something, go watch them make legislation. And it's kind of like putting toothpaste into the tube rather than taking it out of the tube. Anybody want to jump in here? Is there anything here that...
The idea behind contacting the consulate is that the idea would be if a person was, shall we say, grew up in a foreign country, was maybe here in another country for a brief time, that they would be at a loss and not understand, shall we say, the local, shall we say, legal system, laws, perhaps even language, and in effect be kind of lost if they were arrested and accused of a crime.
How do we know what this treaty envisions?
Well, that would...
I hear you say that.
It is clearly not envisioned.
But somebody's been here since they were two.
Make it since they were awake. It's not envisioned. The purpose would be, because what's the difference between somebody whose mother gave birth, they're in one country or here, if they've grown up and assimilated and are familiar with this country?
What if Cuba shot down the U-2 plane?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't Mr. Powers, the pilot, have some right to consult with a consul? We don't have consuls in Cuba. But certainly the consul from Switzerland that's doing America's work over there. Wouldn't that be a thing?
Yeah, but he was a citizen of the U.S. He did, wasn't raised. An entirely different situation.
And he got shot down by some kind of Soviet missile. You got three countries involved instead of just two.
Larry Douglas earlier and I were talking about this, and he was telling me the argument that the appellate lawyers would make in this case. And perhaps Larry would like to join this discussion.
Yeah, Larry, jump in here.
Well, I guess the big concern that I have is that we're claiming that what the violation of the treaty so forth would jeopardize American citizens, and it's almost like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy if it happens, because we're saying we're doing something wrong and it's going to jeopardize citizens, and I think that's wrong for us to do. That's the first thing. But the lawyers for the for Mr. Leal was claiming in essence that contacting the Mexican consul would have allowed Mr. Leal to obtain better lawyers who would have done a better job in trying the case in the first place, which is not a place that she can go to if indeed that were the case. Her argument is that if he'd gotten better lawyers, then they could have attack the junk science and so forth?
Well, we've got Dave Atwood here, and Dave Atwood has a history on non-American citizens not talking to consuls.
Hey, Ray, speak up. I can hardly hear you.
I said that we have you on the line, and you have some information about the history of non-American citizens not talking to consuls.
Yeah, this is the fourth Mexican national that I know of that's been executed. And the first one that I went to was back in 1997, Irineo Tristan Montoya, and that was up in Huntsville for that. And there was a big protest by the Mexican government when he was executed, and they realized that they had to get something out to all the Spanish-speaking people in the state, and they developed an information packet to tell people about the Vienna Convention. And that happened right after the Montoya execution. And then there was another one in 2002, Javier Medina. And that was when Bush was governor then, I believe. And President Fox of Mexico had a meeting scheduled to meet with Bush on some other issues, trade probably. And Fox actually canceled that meeting with Bush because Bush went ahead with the execution. And then we had the one in 2008 of Jose Medellin, where again the Supreme Court had made this ruling that's affecting us today. And of course the state of Texas went forward with that one. And then today we have Humberto Leal. And so this is the fourth one that I know of. We've got about...
Dave, I've got a question for you. By the way, I need to inform you that they have crossed the road. The process has begun. That's where we are with the execution.
Okay.
The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, does it seem to make any difference how long the person scheduled to be executed has been in the United States?
You mean that they've lived here for a long time?
Yeah, Leal has been in the United States since he was about 2 years old.
Right, right. Well, I think what that brings up is that we have people like that who have been here a long time. They don't even probably think of themselves as Mexican citizens, and certainly the authorities, when they were arrested, never asked the question.
Well, does it make any difference in the four cases that you have seen an issue like how long have you been here?
No, I really don't. I have never seen that, really. Okay. I think it's gone all over the place. And you know, we have 24, well, now with this execution, 23 foreign nationals on Texas death row still. We have 12 more Mexican nationals. We have other ones from Honduras, Salvador, Nicaragua, Argentina, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got quite a few more, but California has more than we do.
But they're all Latin Americans? We don't have any Europeans?
No. There's somebody from Vietnam, somebody from Bangladesh.
Okay.
They're from all over the place. Cambodia.
Yeah.
Argentina. But the big majority are Mexican nationals, as you probably would expect since they are right next to us.
Incidentally, now that we're on broadcast, the row can hear this show.
Excuse me?
Now that we're on broadcast rather than HD, the row can hear this show.
The role of citizenship?
No, the death row can hear this show.
I can't understand.
The guys on the row.
Oh, okay, right.
Can hear this show now. They're hearing your voice.
Yeah, I know they hear this. This is great. And, you know, all people like myself and Gloria can say, people that are working against the death penalty for a long time, we're just going to keep fighting. And I think at some point we're going to abolish the death penalty. We haven't got there yet, but we know that the citizens of the state are changing. And we think we get a political change up in Austin, I think we could actually abolish the death penalty. Unfortunately, we got some politicians that love the death penalty still, and that's a major part of our problem. So we need to change the political makeup of the state. My two cents on that. And we're going to keep working on it. We're not going to give up.
Dave, tell people how they can get in touch with the coalition.
Well, with our coalition, if they go to our website, which is TCAD TC80P.org. TC80P.org. That's how they can get connected up with us.
Okay, David, how many folks you got out there? You're at St. Stephen's on West Alabama?
About 12, yeah. About 12, 13, 14, something like that right now.
Okay, give our regards to the Vigilance.
Okay.
And we'll be back in touch with you if and when we hear from Huntsville.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Ray. Yeah, bye-bye.
And that was Dave Atwood. So Dave's experience, does that change anything about our discussion here?
My comment on this, I know the treaty perhaps makes no distinction about somebody who I would best say is an accidental citizen of Mexico.
Or incidental.
Incidental. But I think the Mexican government does. I don't know of any protest the Mexican government's lodged against this particular executioner or the Medellin, because Medellin was identical, much of identical case. He was a young infant when he was moved to this country. He was born and raised here, and he's involved in that horrible rape and killing of those young girls. And I don't recall the Mexican government being outraged because Texas was executing him. And I don't recall the Mexican government being outraged about this execution. And frankly, I think had they gotten a hold of the consulate, they'd tell him to take a flying leap at this point, because really, he was really a resident of Texas, but happened to be born in Mexico, and he just happened to come under the auspices of the treaty. And I don't think they'd have done a nickel's worth of work to have helped him. And as Susan had pointed out earlier when we were talking, if an American citizen had gone to Mexico and that had been accused and done the same thing this guy would have done.
I just received an ominous signal from Elizabeth that the process is apparently completed. Let's see if we have some live reporter to put on that. Is line one for me, Elizabeth? You don't have to do the typing. Okay. Kelly, this is Ray. You're back in the studio now.
Okay, Ray. We have Anicia, who is Humberto's second cousin, and she is waiting to say a few words.
Please, put her on the air.
Just a second. Hello, Ray?
Anicia, I am sorry about your primo.
Yes, I know.
Well, you're on the radio. If you have any statements to make about anything, it's your radio station. Help yourself.
Well, I feel it was wrong for them to do this to my cousin. They should have given him another chance to continue the investigation to find more evidence, because I knew he wasn't alone.
Well, I want...
Our family is so hurt because they took another blood from the family.
Well... Is the family going to go over to the funeral home?
Yes.
Okay.
But he will not be buried here. He will be buried in his hometown in Monterrey.
Okay. Well, my regards and sympathy to your family. And thank you. Thank you for joining us. And could you put Kelly on for just a second?
Yes. Ray.
Thank you, Kelly,
for giving her a voice.
Bye-bye. I'll explain all of the cemetery stuff. And so to the audience, what happens now is Humberto's family will go over to the Huntsville Funeral Home because that's where Humberto is going right now. They're now that he's dead, they're putting him on a gurney and they carry him out the back door. The Carnes Funeral Services here in Houston has the contract, and they will carry him over to the Huntsville Funeral Home, which is contracted to receive the body on behalf of the family. And the family will rush over there and feel his body while there's still warmth in it, because as long as he's been on death row, none of his family have been allowed to touch him. I know that sounds like a very morbid ritual, but it is an instilled part of the execution ritual. From there, the body will be transported to Carnes, prepared for transportation to Mexico. That either will be an embalming or cremating, but they won't transport the body further than from Huntsville to Carnes Funeral Home without doing further preparation on it. That's the law, and that's what happens. The body belongs to the family in Texas. Bodies of deceased are property, and they belong to the next of kin. That's another part of the ritual that a lot of people don't understand. But Texas convicts frequently go to great lengths to make arrangements to get married to somebody so there will be a next of kin to take care of their remains. If nobody claims their remains, they will be buried in Joe Bird Cemetery, which is called by the inmates Peckerwood Hill. You can see it yourself. It's between the college and 19, Texas Highway 19, just past the Gopher Bowl. Go over there, and there are acres and acres of tombstone markers. Been there, saw that. It's been enough. I'm going to bring in Dennis Longmire. Dennis, is that you?
Yes, it is. Let me know if you have problems hearing me, because I'm on my cell phone.
Okay, I hope you're not bicycling while you're talking to us. That could get to be dangerous.
It would be more than dangerous to see me on a bicycle telephoning or not.
Dennis Longmire is a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. He's a regular guest on Execution Watch, sometimes as a reporter at the front gate of the execution chambers, and at other times as an expert on this subject. Dennis, it is yours. I'll get out of your way.
Well, I mean, tonight's execution was remarkable for a number of reasons. First of all, because it's one of the first executions in a long time since that the President of the United States has actively gotten involved in the process. As you may remember, the last time that happened was when President Bush was trying to convince Governor Perry to stop the Medean execution, which also involved international issues concerning consular rights. And so for that reason alone, I think it is somewhat noteworthy. I'm very disappointed that our governor did not have the political fortitude to be able to stand up and say, let's wait and see what happens. If the United States Senate and then the Congress pass a law that requires that these cases be examined, we're going to look very, very silly in the eyes of the local, national community. We already look silly in the eyes of the international community, but there was no need for us to rush through this process.
Dennis, I've been told that this is the third time they've made attempts to forward this legislation, and that has not been happening.
Well, I'm not familiar with the legislative history of that action, and so that may well be true, and maybe the third time is a charm. I know that I always come to the corner with a hopeful imagination, and I'm always hopeful that something is going to make us stop. And once we stop for an appreciable period of time, we're not going to go back through it.
What has happened to executions in Illinois recently? And
well,
how many states are there that have given up on this?
Well, you know, Illinois did. They abolished the death penalty this legislative session after a long dance with moratorium and with commissions and everything else. And so the state of Illinois, this year, has walked away from this process. I just learned that California, a council member from Berkeley, has introduced legislation in California to abolish the death penalty there and substitute life without parole in its stead. And her arguments are principally driven by the cost. You know, California has recently been suffering even worse fiscal concerns than we have, and they've come to realize that they can better spend their money trying to build the community rather than trying to torture it and tear it down.
They're not actually executing people in California anyway.
Well, that's the other irony, is that they aren't. And Illinois hadn't either. And so when Illinois and California back off, it doesn't make a huge dent in the actual numbers of executions. Of course, if California backs off, that's a very significant population base and a large, large number. California has more people on death row than Texas. And so if those people all get commuted to life, Texas will immediately become the leader in terms of the numbers of people on death row awaiting execution.
For those of you who left your slide rules and calculators at home, California is the most populous state in the United States. Texas is second, and New York is third.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I always have to try to remind everyone, myself included, is that when we talk about simple numbers, we have to always put them in the context of the ratio of the population at large.
Well, Dennis, you sound almost optimistic that we're going to see the end of this program, and I would be very grateful for that. Any way thing you can do to help that forward, let me know.
Well, I appreciate that. And as I said, I've been coming out to the corner for so long, I have to come out with a sense of hope. If I had the sense of despair that is really kind of on the subsurface of my feelings right now, I wouldn't be here. I would be at home holding my head in my hand or in my church on my knees. I do hope. I have a hope that there will be an awareness, an awakening, if you will, and people will begin to let people like Governor Perry understand that we don't have to kill in order to demonstrate support for victims of violence. It's, to me, just it's irony squared for us to somehow claim we owe the victims of these horrendous crimes homicide. We owe them a homicide. It baffles my line of thinking.
Are you carrying a summer class load?
I am. I'm teaching a seminar on the death penalty for my doctoral students. Three of them came out to the execution this evening. Normally, I don't intermingle classes with this particular vigil that I do. It seemed appropriate to at least make the announcement to my class yesterday, and three of the 10 students came. One of the students who came is a doctoral student from Thailand, and himself acknowledged that the death penalty is not a small issue there, that it is also very, very controversial in Thailand. They do a lot more executions there, but it is something that he's very interested in also.
Well, if you encounter my friend Jerry Bruce, give him my regards, and thank you very much for being on Execution Watch.
I certainly will. Thank you for having me.
That was Dennis Longmire. He is a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. You can scamper right up there and get a class load, pick up a couple of good degrees, and then join Execution Watch if we're not dead by the time you get here. And now we're back to Larry, Jim, and Susan. We're halfway through here. Just one sidebar. You know, I've got these crazy ideas in my toward the end of George Bush's term as governor. I mean, he was killing everything he could get in line. I mean, the death warrants he had smelled of Mimeo ink. Does anybody remember Mimeo machines?
Mimeograph machines. Everybody had purple hands.
Yeah, right. It was purple hands. That's how rapidly he was turning. He was killing everything. And I said, what's the matter with this man? And a very wise, older friend of mine said, didn't you know that George Bush has got to kill more people to prove that he is the alpha male that deserves to be president of the United States? And now Rick Perry has started. I find that daunting. So with that piece of inane, absent humor thrown in, anybody want to take off on this, Larry?
I will.
Okay, Susan, go ahead.
I will. One of the things we've never talked about, I don't think you've ever talked about on this show, is if you look at the historically, and if you go back in time and you look at societies, that societies have always, shall we say, killed people by group decision. Okay, if you go back to the most ancient days, in the concept really was that to have the benefits of living in society, you had to, shall we say, keep the social compact. You had to behave in a way that people would want you to be part of that society. And so, of course, people, shall we say, if they violated what the group was going to tolerate, in the ancient world, they killed them. Okay, they didn't, shall we say, they didn't imprison them typically. If it was bad enough, killed them.
Prison right. Was basically a 19th century concept.
Right. Now, crimes against women, since I'm the only woman here, I guess I have to take this up. The crimes of rape and murder against a woman, clearly it's a crime against a woman, but historically it was really considered a crime against the men.
Property. Right.
It was considered a crime against the honor of the man and the family and the whole society. It was a crime against the males, if you go back in time. That was actually, and it was also considered that the, shall we say, the family and the society, the closer they were to the woman, they were actually duty and honor bound to avenge it.
Yeah, the old biblical code is
right.
The family did it.
And the from the Latin word, if you take the word vengeance and you go the original word, say, that developed, okay, was the Latin word. I don't know if anyone took Latin, but it was vindicare. That is the Latin word. And then it kind of came into Italian, which we're very familiar with that, vendetta. There was an old French word.
I used to date her, actually.
There was an old French word, and in English we say vengeance. Mm-hmm. It is said in Italy that voices from the grave cry for honor, and that female voices scream the loudest.
Oh,
and they
that?
Will never stop.
Well, that would make sense.
Makes sense to me.
And that female voices scream the loudest.
And never
and
quit.
They will not stop until people use. That's
well, no,
where,
no,
it, I mean, I'm
no,
just
the,
telling
the
you,
old,
that is
old,
historically.
The Old Testament code, if you challenged my honor or you stole and killed my wife or any of my many concubines, then I was duty-bound, what remained of my family, to
that's right.
Take care of that business. At some point, it wasn't only death. Hammurabi kind of come in and said, all right, this killing everybody for everything is not going to work. So if you cost somebody their eye, we'll take your eye. I mean, I think Hammurabi was a bleeding heart liberal movement to limit the punishment to no greater than the crime. That's pretty austere. Of course, that's considered pretty serious stuff now. But at least everybody didn't get killed. And then somewhere down the line, they used banishment. Remember that wonderful short story by, what's his name? Jack London. Outcast of Poker Flats, were the people with the real integrity, the ones who had been banished from society.
Because they have broken their social compact.
And so prison, because we don't have anywhere to send you, we're going to build a cage and just put you out of sight. And there have been several documentaries lately based on that prison in Philadelphia where my documentary was filmed. And the problem with that is you give people all that isolation to be prayerful and penitent, just drove them crazy. And so they had to get rid of that. The whole idea of criminal justice reform has gone through a great many evolutions and a great many reforms. It's always we've got a better idea. The guillotine works better than the rope, or the rope works better than the sword or the hatchet.
The guillotine was brought in originally to be a humanitarian.
Right.
Was actually brought because it was so swift and effective that it was actually considered a more humanitarian way to execute
but
people.
The royals reserved for themselves the swords and the axes because they didn't trust this mechanical thing. They're better than the rest of us. So all of this evolution, all that, and here we are in the 21st century, at least I think it is, and it's still not working. I mean, we have a crime, right? I mean, my God, you can go to Fort Worth and get killed on any given day of the week. Is that true?
Not usually. Except on Sunday. They take Sunday off.
They take Sunday
off,
but they go to church on Sunday. Larry, have you been anywhere where there was no crime?
Never. But I guess where we are right now is that, you know, in a civilized society, we find it distasteful to kill your own citizens. But it's just a matter of what are we going to do? Where do we go from here? If we opposed to the death penalty, what's the best way to oppose it? And it seems as though these lines of cases seem to suggest that the opposition to the death penalty, those of us who oppose, some of them have taken the position that if you delay it, that's a victory. Rick Perry can, I believe.
No, that's a point that I would like to talk to you about, because it appears to me that as we get ready to execution, we get into a chicken race where two trains are headed at one another, and it's to see who flinches. Does the state flinch, or does the defense just give up? But these trains are going to have a collision, and I don't like that last-minute pressure. I'd love to come into the show and all of a sudden we get a stay And because we have a stay, we can do a breaking news story. That's great because somebody didn't get killed. But in every other case, Elizabeth is running herself to death trying to get in touch with the Attorney General's office, check with the Supreme Court and see what's going on over there, seeing with the governor's office if there's a clemency possibility in all of this, which recently there has not been. But there's all of this last-minute stuff. That must be torture for the guy that's carrying in, strapping in the gurney.
Clearly it has to be, and in this case, it's my understanding that the governor, on his own, after the Board of Pardons and Paroles has spoken, can delay the process for 30 days.
That's
all he can do.
Well, Elizabeth is trying to get in here.
Oh, yeah, excuse me. Ray, I just wanted to mention, or just throw in my two cents about the last-minute dealings, and that is that, according to a friend of the show who was at death row today visiting a relative of her own, she said that Humberto Leal was being visited by his family and also representatives of the Mexican government. And, you know, the Mexican government put all kinds of money into his defense and into lobbying the U.S. government to put off his execution. And apparently, while our friend was there, the guards came to take Humberto the half-hour drive down to the death house in Huntsville. And she said it was a very emotional scene when the family and the Mexican government officials found out that they had to leave, and that was it. And I'm curious how our panel of legal minds feels about the dire predictions that are continuing to flout the Vienna Convention, or Rick Perry's continuing.
Well, we spent much of the program talking about that. And here is, we got to talk, we got to explain to our producer what we're doing.
I know, I was on the phone, sorry.
She was on the phone doing work. Here's the bottom line, is that we have signed a treaty. The convention is a treaty, and we've signed that, and it's been adopted. But there is no explaining legislation as to how to implement it. And they have made three attempts to get through Congress, including the attempt talked about at the end of Amy's show just before we went on the air. And it ain't happening. Now, I don't know what you think about the current Congress, but, I mean, we've got serious logjam in the United States Congress now. The Republicans control one house, the Democrats barely control the other house, and so trying to get enough cooperation in the legislative process to pass implementing legislation to implement that treaty is a pipe dream.
Well, let me mention this. Let's assume the following. Let's assume, number one, that the gentleman didn't contact the Mexican consul. Let's assume he got a hearing. And what would you do at the hearing if you were the lawyer? Because at that point, what's your remedy? So he violated the treaty. What you going to do about it? Because that doesn't destroy the fact the state still had the evidence prior to his arrest of him leaving the party with a drunk girl. A brother came back and saying he'd killed a girl, then finding the body and finding a bloody blouse in his house. What would you have accomplished by giving a hearing, even if there had been a treaty? There was a treaty violation, there's no doubt about that. Assuming that to be true, what would you have accomplished by having a hearing and saying, well, we violated the treaty? And your answer would be, well, so what? What would you accomplish by that hearing? What would you do?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what is their message? If you are within the sound of our voice and you can understand what we're saying and you are a citizen of another country and you want to kill somebody, start screaming, I want to talk to my consul before the police get there. So that they will understand that that's what you want to do. Now, when that happens and you go see the consul and they start shrugging their shoulders and saying, sucker, you're on your own.
Well, see, in this case, the consul, they only have the right to be advised of that after the arrest. Well, in this case, most of the damaging evidence was gathered before they were already done. So my point is, assuming that you would have a hearing for a treaty violation, and there was a treaty violation, assuming you have a hearing, what would you accomplish by that hearing? How would you get the case reversed?
Well, see, I don't think reversal's on the table, Jim.
I don't either.
I don't see that reversal's on the table. I still think that what people should do in the event of a crime for which there may be execution or even serious sentence, I think that we should respect the fact that not everybody here is a citizen of this country, and they should be advised with their counsel. If for no other reason, then it's an extra step in the Miranda readings.
Okay, one thing we've talked about just briefly, I want to go back to. If you look at the procedural history of this, my God, he filed, he filed probably five or six different post-conviction writs, had lawyers doing all of this work for him. And my question would be, if an American citizen had gone to another country and committed the same act, would have he had the same due process rights and given the same sort of treatment this man was given by our courts? Although we've been critical of what we've done, my God, there was a ton of work done to save this man's life. My question is, if an American citizen had gone to another country and committed the same act that this man had committed, where their courts have been as generous as our courts have been, although we've been critical of them, because they've entertained at least three writs in state court and at least three writs in federal court, a request for DNA testing. It's one of the longest procedural histories I've ever seen in the case.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Jim, but then other countries don't necessarily hold themselves up to be the high standard heirs of Roman law, English common law. I mean, other countries don't hold themselves up to have the kind of legal system that we do. We brag about that. We point to other people and say, well, you're not up to our standards all over the world. I think anybody that brags of that ought to produce it. I think we've got to listen to those writs. I think we've got to consider it simply because that is who we are and that is what is required of us.
And that's what I'm saying.
I guess it all depends upon, a lot of people are against the death penalty. So either you're going to have it or you're not going to have it. But the other question is, in this case, what if the treaty had not been violated?
Mm-hmm.
Would it have made much of a difference, if any difference at all? And if you're in opposition to the death penalty, then what is the best tactic to take in terms of eliminating it? Because the process of any delay is a victory does not, I don't think, support your position nearly as reasonably as taking some other steps and just saying, look, we're against it for specific logical reasons. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's not proper. It's not appropriately applied. The other kinds of things that I think would be a lot more reasonably would be a lot more reasonable to devote your efforts toward.
Well, it's come that time when we've got to start doing credits and wrapping up. My name is Ray Hill. I am a volunteer at radio station KPFT in Houston. This program is broadcast on the main broadcast channel of KPFT. You're listening to it on 90.1 FM. And it is also broadcast on HD1 channel. A little better quality, although I don't know if quality improves our show bet because we don't do that professional of a job with mics. Whatever we do is in the hands of young Luke Jones, who is our producer in there with his hands on the buttons and the switches. And Luke is a regular feature here on KPFT. You hear his voice often during the news, giving traffic reports and other things. And we appreciate his helping us out on the execution watch tonight. Nothing would happen if it were not for Elizabeth Stein. Elizabeth Stein is our executive producer, and she puts in many, many hours of work. I have to say, Jim Skelton spends some midnight oil putting together the history of these cases. We try to bring them to you as succinctly as possible. Frequently, they are not pretty cases. They are ugly cases, and he passed that on over to Susan Ashley to do tonight, and she did the dirty duty of explaining all about this case, and I saw her struggle and wince her way through that. But we try to bring you an accurate characterization of what happened. And, of course, Larry's voice is something really spectacular to have on the show, if nothing else. having him in to occasionally laugh and add that deep quality of voice. We are a strange show. We are not here next week, I don't think. When's our next one, Elizabeth? has got...
I believe the next one is going to be the 20th. And that's, I can't think of his name, but he's the one who
Larry's got paperwork.
Okay. Oh, it's actually at the bottom of the rundown. It's the one who's, it's the hate crime where the guy went around
shooting people who looked
Arabic.
Sure. It's
on the rundown.
Yeah, it's one of the things. And at any rate, we looks like we'll be here on the 20th. And when we return, here we go. The next execution is going to be Mark Stroman, and that's going to happen on July the 20th. There are other executions scheduled, so we will have a run through the summer, and hopefully, unless something happens, we'll get rid of it.
Right, and Ray, I just wanted to mention that anybody who wants details can go to executionwatch.org.
As a matter of fact, by the time we get off this program and clear the station, there'll be an archive of this show, an archive of all the shows we've done.
Exactly, and also there's Execution
Watch.
Have
we got a count of how many shows we've done? We've done over 50
shows. I'll do a count, and I'll let you know.
We've done over 50 shows.
And we've got, now, something that's new, though, is we have a Facebook page, and I've been posting more and more updates on there. And just if you want to go to Facebook and like Execution Watch, you can get out on the discussion. A number of people called during the show, and I told them, please go to our Facebook page and get in on the discussion.
Well, it's been... we don't do this because we enjoy doing it. We do this because we think you need to hear it, and because it's your world and your society, and you're the body politic. You're listening to Radio Hill on radio station KPFT in Houston. I've got to tell Otis McClay is the guy that maintains our website and keeps it up to date. The theme music you're about to hear is by Victoria Panetti, and you can find her SheMonster, myspace.com/SheMonster. This is Ray Hill. I'll be back with you on the 20th, unless we fortunately get a stay.